This week on Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. Spike Lee is in the house for the launch of the BFI's season celebrating 20 years since the release of the groundbreaking Do the Right Thing. Spike and I will be discussing the film's legacy, including the role it played in bringing Barack and Michelle Obama together. After Atonement, Joe Wright talks Hollywood, music and mania as he directs Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey Jr. in The Soloist. And Zan Brooks will be along to review The Soloist, as well as the documentary deluxe Crimson Wing, starring, well, lots of flamingos. And we'll also be reviewing the reissue of Francis Ford Coppola's The Godfather. Yes, it's an offer you can't refuse. It's Film Weekly.
You almost knocked me down, man. The word is excuse me.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Not only did you knock me down, you used to buy my brand new white Air Jordans I just bought. And that's all you can say is excuse me.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I'm serious. I'll fuck you up quick two times. Who told you to step on my sneakers? Who told you to walk on my side of the block? Who told you to be in my neighborhood?
I own this brownstone.
Who told you to buy a brownstone on my block in my neighborhood on my side of the street? Yo, what you want to live in a black neighborhood for anyway, man? Motherfuck gentrification.
Well,
as I understand it, this is a free country. Man can live wherever he wants.
Free country? Man, I should fuck you for saying that stupid shit alone.
Yo, man, your Jordans are fucked up.
It is hard to believe that 20 years have passed since the release of Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, 1989, Sound of Another Summer, Sound of the Funky Drummer. To prove that 20 years on, he can still do the right thing, Spike Lee joined me earlier this week right here in the Guardian Studios to discuss the legacy of Do the Right Thing. Spike, welcome to In the Director's Chair. What a great pleasure to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
I must say that that we're celebrating 20 years of Do the Right Thing, 1989 that came out, and you're in London to celebrate the anniversary of that with a season of films at BFI South Bank, our national film theatre. But they're not films all about you, they're films that influence you, influence this film, and then this film in turn has influenced. It has become a sort of centrepiece film of filmmaking. Back 20 years ago, could you have ever imagined the kind of legacy that Do the Right Thing might have had?
No, it's something we hope for, but it's not something you can count on. And a lot of people forget, you know, when this film came out, it was said by some people, again, that it was going to cause riots all across America.
Did you know it was an incendiary film when you were making it? Did you know that it had a kind of explosive colors?
I really would not use the word incendiary, because right away you think that something's, you know, burning. I knew the film would provoke discussion, debate, but no way, shape, or form would black people come out of the theater and start the riot. That was just ignorant.
It's amazing that people sort of accused the film that would happen. I don't know any film that's ever happened.
So-called well-respected journalist wrote this.
But it wasn't me, so that's fine.
You're too young.
But it was a film, as I've said, that I read a lukewarm review of it, a review that took issue with the kind of filmmaking on display, the kind of rough and ready style of it. And I was incensed, and it actually, you know, inspired me to take up the pen and become a film critic. So that film is the reason that I'm sat here today. So there's some lovely circular kind of poetry to it all. But it is also a film that, of course, has recently become famous again because Barack Obama and Michelle went to see it on their first date together.
Back in 1989.
Now, you said you wouldn't have called it an incendiary movie. You probably wouldn't have called it a date movie.
Oh, it was a big date movie. I was happy when Mr. Obama told me. That was before he was even... before he became senator from the state of Illinois.
It's a film that kind of, also he wrote about the film in his autobiography. It kind of has shaped his politics in some ways, and therefore the politics of America. That's an amazing feat for a film to have done.
Well, I don't know how far it shaped his politics, I think it's historical that this is a film, and not only what the film's done, it's really... It's grown larger in stature as the years have gone on. And I've said this, I don't want to seem redundant, but people forget the best film that year, according to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, Driving Miss Daisy.
A film with very different politics involved in it.
A film no one has seen.
One of the great film-going experiences of my life was at the Venice Film Festival when I watched When the Levees Break, your four-hour opus. I sat there for all of the 4 hours. I couldn't move from my seat to watch this wonderful, wonderful piece of tribute to Katrina. Mm-hmm. Was that a... It seemed to me that was a project that I don't think you meant to be 4 hours when you started, but it could...
No, we were supposed to be two.
Right.
It was for HBO, and Sam Pollard, editor and co-producer, as we're doing this, like, 2 hours is not enough, so we had to go back to HBO, ask for more time and more money, and they gave it to us.
I can't even remember what was what in Harley. There was a hotel right there.
People who follow hurricanes know that the primary amount of damage from a hurricane is from the northeast quadrant, and the northeast quadrant of Hurricane Katrina primarily affected Hancock and Harrison and Jackson counties in Mississippi. There was a ton of devastation along the Mississippi Gulf Coast, which a lot of times seems to go unnoticed by the media.
This is Second Street. Oh my God.
This is Second Street.
It's a work of great scope. It kind of goes into the...
That's why we needed 4 hours.
It's something that is a very different skill, making a documentary to the feature. Or do you find that
they help each other. So my skills as a documentary filmmaker help my narrative filmmaker. My narrative filmmaking skills will help my documentary skills. So
in what way? What is it? Is it about storytelling?
You get a cigar.
Oh, good.
Give the man a cigar. Storytelling. That's for me. That's the most important thing as a filmmaker. Storytelling.
But it seems to me that you kind of keep digging up the stories. There's almost not enough time for you for some of the work you want to do. I mean, Four Little Girls, again, a wonderful piece of...
Thank you.
Film. But you've tried to do... You're doing it with sports stars now?
Well, I did one called Kobe Doing Work, One Game, Kobe Bryant.
Which played at the Tribeca Film Festival earlier this year.
Right, and hopefully you get to do one on Michael Jordan.
They're going to do one up because these were influenced by, I think we've discussed this before, by the Zidane portrait by Douglas Gordon and Philip Pereno.
Kobe Doing Work, the Michael Jordan one will not be.
Right. There's been talk of you going to do a John Coltrane biopic at some stage. Nope, that's not happening. No, we could tick off the projects that you've been attached to.
I don't know where that came from. That's not true.
Right. Presumably because of the wonderful Love Supreme montage that you used in Jungle Fever.
Not true.
Right. A Miles Davis.
Not true.
Not true. who are you doing?
Who I like to do?
Yeah.
James Brown, that's true. Couldn't get the money. Film about Joe Louis and Max Schmeling, that's true. Couldn't get the money.
It's amazing to me, Spike, that after all these films that are key works in recent filmmaking, you struggle to get the money.
Well, I'm not saying this as sour grapes. Unless you're Spielberg, Lucas, a couple other people. That's just the way it is in this industry now.
Mm-hmm. Spike, congratulations on 20 years.
Thank you very much.
Do the Right Thing. I can't believe it's 20 years since I saw it.
It's gone quick.
Well, thank you for sitting in our chair for this half hour. It's been a great pleasure to have you on the show and a great ambition of mine.
Thank you.
Thank you for making me a film critic, Spike Lee. The great Spike Lee there. And for more information on the BFI season, go to bfi.org.uk. You can also watch a video version of that interview, a second cut, by going to guardian.co.uk in the director's chair. And joining me now to fight the power and review this week's releases is Guardian film critic at large, Zan Brooks. Welcome to the pod.
Thank you, Jason.
Zan, we'll be reviewing this week The Soloist with Jamie Foxx and Robert Downey Jr. We'll be looking at The Crimson Wing, Mystery of the Flamingos, and The Godfather, to which I need to add a little more. But let's start with The Soloist, because we're going to hear from Joe Wright, the director of The Soloist, in a bit. Now, this is Jamie Foxx on the streets of Los Angeles. He's discovered by a journalist, Robert Downey Jr. Jamie Foxx is a kind of brilliant genius cellist, but he's now suffering from schizophrenia, so he's on Skid Row.
Right. I mean, I like it. What do you think? It's nice. It's clean. The bathroom's better than... except for him.
I don't want to die in here.
Don't.
Somebody could just come fine. Here and kill me.
Nathaniel? Nathaniel, the door locks.
What if in 12 days someone walks through that door and murders me? And I don't care about this Clayton thing either. Walt Disney Hall, Disney Duck. It doesn't make a difference. I don't need any of that. If I'm going to take a lesson, I should take the lesson in the tunnel where I can hear the city sounds. Mm-hmm. And I'll be locked off from life, locked off from the world. In the tunnel, I can hear the music the way it's supposed to be played. Not in this place. There's no city sounds. There's no Beethoven. There's no Los Angeles, California. I don't belong here. I'm never coming here again.
So Jamie Foxx there in The Soloist. It strikes me as odd, isn't it? Because Robert Downey Jr. was in Tropic Thunder last year, got an Oscar nomination for a film which I couldn't bear at all. But there was a kind of strain of do mental illness in there and you get an Oscar.
Yeah, Hollywood goes mad.
Mm, and here he is in a film, The Soloist, kind of looking after a guy with a mental illness.
Yeah.
I was very nervous when I heard that Joe Wright was making a film about Jamie Foxx who was going to be doing the kind of mental illness thing. Do you think that he got away with it?
Not entirely. I had sort of problems with this film, and I think the main problem was that I couldn't work out whether this was a sort of middle-brow Oscar bait that wanted to be a kind of edgy, gritty art house movie, or the other way around.
Yeah, it's kind of all of those things. Although it had a very strange release pattern. It's coming out now. I mean, they obviously don't think it's going to get Oscars because it was kind of put up to be Oscars.
On the face of it, it totally is that.
Yeah.
It's completely A Beautiful Mind or Shine. It's the homeless hobo genius who's deeply troubled but so brilliant that you make allowances.
But the film sort of isn't that. Though,
no,
when you
I know.
Watch it. And I think that that's kind of distracting to have those labels on because I think it's a very good film, but it isn't a brilliant film and it doesn't have Oscar performances in it, even though I like Downey, even though Jamie Foxx, I think, reins it in or is reined in by the director as much as possible as a kind of genius cellist with a silver coat can be reined in.
The performances, by and large, are pretty good, I think. I like both of them as an actor. I think particularly Downey Jr., I think, is always good value.
Yeah.
I thought the problem was slightly more with the direction. And that's not to say that Joe Wright isn't a talented filmmaker, which he obviously is.
Yep.
I thought that he was sort of pulling in various different directions with this and wasn't quite sure exactly what he wanted to do
I think
it.
You're exactly right. I think everything gets a kind of fair shot, a fair crack of the whip. Mm. There's a bit of a newspaper story because Steve Lopez, played by Robert Downey Jr., is in the LA Times, which is kind of undergoing, like State of Play, we saw recently, it's the last days of newspapers. Now, do news journalists still have power? All that's there, and there's a sort of subplot where, you know, there's a guy who gets fired from the newspaper, and that's kind of very much in the background. So it's about that. It's also about the kind of the power of newspaper to kind of maybe make the mayor give some money to the homeless. It's also about the homeless. It's also about kind of schizophrenia. It's also about the friendship between these two guys.
Yeah.
So there's a lot going on, and I think everything tries to
possibly
kind of get
too much. Going
yeah, the plate's
on,
spinning.
And he's just throwing everything at the screen, and things go a little bit wrong in the mix. And, you know, it's that thing again, Robert Downey Jr. playing Steve Lopez. It's that thing of Hollywood always shows journalists to be total social disasters themselves. So here,
where they get this from, I have no idea.
I have no idea. I mean, we're all completely sane and serene here in The Guardian. So Lopez has Catherine Keener playing his ex-wife, who's also his editor, and all the problems of that, which are explored.
And again, she's very good, I think,
she's very good.
In the sort of three or four thumbnail scenes that she's given.
Yeah, she is good. There's a lot. The problem I had with it was the whole sort of Skid Row section, which I thought was a little bit dodgy.
Maybe even morally,
certainly aesthetically. He uses the homeless as extras, and maybe there's something to be said for giving these people a voice and a face on the screen and showing what it's like. I thought that he was still amping it up. It's like a kind of Hieronymus Bosch nightmare. This Skid Row.
Yeah, it is.
It
reminded me of talking about Spike Lee on the show as well. Of course, it reminded me slightly of the Krakow scene, the Living for the City Krakow scene in Jungle Fever. It's going into that nightmare of Skid Row
in that slight sort of tourism quality.
Yeah, and it's kind of high production values for
it
as well.
Yes, exactly.
So it's
maybe
kind of,
that's it. Maybe
I think
that's
the
problem.
It's shot in the same way,
and then it ends with the homeless all dancing on the street, and it felt a little bit exploitative.
But they are the real homeless.
They are the real homeless,
actors.
But they're being told to act.
Yeah.
So therein lies the slight problem.
I did feel that there was a sort of strain of deep sympathy with them as well.
Yes, I think it's entirely well-intentioned. But the handling, I thought, was a little crass.
Yeah, I think you might be right. And I think that might be the problem. Because I actually went out to the set of this. And I went to Skid Row with Joe Wright and his kind of
crew. Did you fit right in?
No, I mean, it was fairly nightmarish. It is quite scary.
I'm sure it is.
And it's a kind of unknown secret to the festering sore of LA. You know, yeah. Hollywood Hills in the background and this in the right in the foreground of downtown LA. So it was quite scary. So I have seen it. So when it came back on the screen, much as whenever you've been on set and you see the scene that you've been seeing, you say, well, I was there for that.
Yeah.
I didn't think that this was too much because okay. it is well, actually qualified, like that. Right. However, I was very surprised to see it look so of a piece with the rest of it, which is the kind of glossy kind of yeah. look, kind of very very well shot. Kind
yes,
of
very well lit yeah. and aestheticized, I guess.
Yeah. So that's The Soloist, which, I mean, I just think it's a really nice film. Again, about the impossibility
of friendship.
It's a
very interesting film. Yeah. It's a flawed film, but it is a fascinating film.
To Africa now, Zan, on Pink Wings for The Crimson Wing, The Mystery of the Flamingos. What is The Mystery of the Flamingos?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of mysteries here, but there's also a kind of identikit quality to these flamingos. We're told that, by Mariella Frostrup, no less, that...
Of this parish.
Of this parish. That all of these flamingos who gather on this lake in Tanzania have their own story and their own secret. And yet I was kind of watching them thinking, well, this story looks pretty much the same. They're all kind of walking in the same direction. They're all having sex with each other. How is these stories different?
Yeah, well,
and I don't know. And I came out of this film still not knowing.
No.
None of them goes and solves a crime. No. None of them drives a car. They're all doing pretty much the same thing.
I would like
thing.
To see Robert Downey Jr., who's of course being Sherlock Holmes soon,
yeah.
solving the mystery of the flamingos.
That would be great.
Wouldn't
that
be a film?
Yeah.
With
how would you
Frostrup?
Pick out the guilty party? Because they, you know, I don't think it's racist to say all these flamingos look alike.
Some are whiter than others, though, because the ones that eat eat the natron, they become crimson. When the chicks are born, they're all fluffy white.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you can't. Your heart surely melted when you saw a little baby flamingo trying to stand for the first time.
Yes, and, you know, it's hard to hold back a tear when they're wading through these little salt sediments and they get these kind of concrete leg warmers on that hobble them. And, you know, there's always that, isn't there? There's always there's the flamingo who's not going to make
and
it.
And as Mariella fruitily tells us in her voiceover, that it's just luck as to whether these cement kind of leg warmers will slow them down, allowing the marabou stalks, like storybook witches.
Like storybook witches, yeah.
To come in.
The feathers are pink, but the prose is quite purple.
Isn't it? Very good, San. I thought the use of Mariella... dear, I hope she's not listening. Love your work, darling. But I just thought it's made it sound like an advert for cheap perfume.
It really does. It really does. And it kind of gets in the way because it does look great. It does look amazing. There is something fascinating about watching these very strange characters who look like sort of bustling, slightly irritable ballet dancers.
They remind me of like hockey sticks or those. Do you remember the advert for the milk board with the Humphrey straws, the red and white
yes,
Humphrey
yes,
straws?
Yes, yes, they do look like that. They do look like that. And they kind of gather and clack and bang into each other. And you know, there's something interesting about it. I guess maybe I have a prejudice against these sort of National Geographic style documentaries. I mean, this is by Disney. But they give me this sort of weird existential frisson. I can't identify with these characters.
If we'd have swapped Mariella for Werner Herzog.
Exactly. Herzog puts himself entirely in there and makes no bones about it. Mariella is this sort of lofty voice of the goddess.
She's the commenting. Well, she's not quite Morgan Freeman, who obviously did help the March of the Penguins to Oscar glory. But with the Penguins, there was this dramatic story where they go to the sea and they've got to make it back. The flamingos don't seem to have this epic journey. They kind of flock. They kind of give birth and
some of them
fly
get
around
eaten.
A bit. And some of them get eaten. There's a mongoose.
Some have sex.
Yeah. The flamingos do it standing up. I was intrigued.
They do. They're
that.
Acrobatic birds.
Yeah. But this being Disney, that didn't quite get into the nitty-gritty of it.
That's for the director's
cut. I did thought the music was lovely, actually. Cinematic orchestra.
Music's great, and it looks amazing. And yet I always watch these things thinking, I have no point of connection here. I can watch it, and it is fascinating. But these flamingos are not like you and I.
They are not. Zan, let's move on to a classic, a dyed-in-the-wool classic, The Godfather, the only film to, I suppose, get 5 stars across the board, generally hailed to be the greatest film ever made when Citizen Kane, when people forget Citizen Kane and change their lists. It's re-released on the big screen by Park Circus, who are doing this quite a lot. We had Scarface the other week. Do you remember that? We talked about that. And I sort of posited, rather kind of blasé-ly, perhaps controversially, that I preferred Scarface to The Godfather.
Oh, that's interesting, because I think I would agree with you. I would say The Godfather is a bona fide five-star classic. It is a classic of 70s American cinema. I don't think it's as good as it's cracked up to be.
Is this because we can all do an impression of Marlon Brando?
Oh, Godfather, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do.
You can act like a man! What's the matter with you? Is this how you turn down a Hollywood Pinocchio that cries like a woman? What can I do? What can I do? What is that, man? You look terrible. I want you to eat. I want you to rest well, and a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
Too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
And that wasn't actually an impression of Marlon Brando. That was Marlon Brando, who's quite good, I suppose. But do you think it is because it's become such a template?
Yeah, maybe it's so ubiquitous and maybe so influential that it's hard to view it in isolation now. And I agree with what you're saying about Scarface in that if there are maybe two slight problems that I have with this film. One is that it does invest the mafia with this sort of dark, noble glamour.
Yeah.
It is a royal family. And I prefer films like Scarface and like Goodfellas that shows it to be pretty shabby and seedy and unpleasant.
Always a bit suburban as
yeah.
well. They have this kind
tacky.
Of royalty, as you say. Yeah. There's a book called Hollywood and the Mob by a journalist called Tim Adler, which sort of blames mafiosi for giving themselves grandeur
yeah.
because of they've seen The Godfather.
I can see that. I can see that. The other problem, and this is sort of, I'm almost embarrassed to say this because I love Marlon Brando so much, but I'm not sure he's perfect in this role. I think that I know he got the Oscar. I know that he's one of the great actors of all time. And yet I love the performances of people like, you know, Al Pacino and Robert Duvall and James Caan and John Cazale. Mm. They seem much more low-key and of a piece with the film. Brando comes there with his star baggage and his mumble. And it's all a little bit hammy.
I always thought so as well. But I mean, it's one of the first films I ever saw. And your dad sits you down and says, you've got to watch The Godfather.
And this is great
this
acting.
Is Marlon Brando,
yeah.
and I think it was that's when I first saw Marlon Brando, who I knew
yeah,
was a legend.
Too, yeah.
I don't think I saw The Wild One when I was like 8 years old, and certainly not Streetcar and the kind of great Brando performances, and certainly not Missouri Breaks, The Wild One. So this was the one, and I was like, is that any good? I can't even understand him.
Yeah.
So we've got cotton wool in his mouth. Is
yeah.
that good acting? I mean, I like the bit when he fell over in the sunflowers chasing his
That's
grandson.
Lovely scene. That's a lovely scene. But some of the others really do sort of stick out and you just see Brando with kind of wadding in his cheeks.
It's a little bit, you're right, it's a little bit. It's too, and I'd seen Mike Yarwood do him, I think, before I'd even seen one.
Yeah, well, yeah.
It's that kind of weird thing that happens with iconography, certainly classics like that. Though James Caan, I think, is great in the scene where they shoot James Caan at the crossing.
Oh,
if anyone's not seen that, spoiler alert, but they shoot James Caan because he deserves it.
You know, we're being perverse here and we're being needlessly nitpicky because it is a great film. It's, you know, Francis Ford Coppola did not want to make this film. He wanted to make the kind of the big European style art movies. But what he does is he smuggles the big European style art movie epic into this pulp novel by Mario Puzo and makes it what he wants to make of it, which is this sort of brilliantly black, elegant, weighty film.
And it's got that wonderful scenes in Sicily, of course, which shows everyone falling off it.
But Sicily. Godfather 2 is better.
I was just going to come to that. It is, isn't it? Maybe.
It is.
It's kind of cooler.
Yeah.
And it's still got the colours. It's still got, and it's got the Cuba stuff. And it's got Michael. What I think happens with Brando is his myth overshadows the fact that this is actually Michael's story.
Yes, exactly.
So if you start seeing them as a trilogy, which I did one weekend, you really follow Michael's story from
yeah.
the start. And
yeah.
then actually makes Godfather 3 actually not as bad as everyone thinks
not
it
as
is.
Bad. Really, not as bad. I mean, that is the narrative line through the Godfather films, and yet Brando just keeps kind of treading on it.
Absolutely. That's The Godfather. It's available on the big screen. Thank you, Zan, for all your opinions this week. If you want to hear more of Zan's opinions and read his articles, go to the best film site in the entire world, guardian.co.uk/film. British director Joe Wright may be on only his third feature film, but his confidence has shone through since his adaptation of Pride and Prejudice in 2005 and the BAFTA-winning Atonement starring Keira Knightley and James McAvoy. With his new film The Soloist, he's moved from the comfort of British culture to the streets of Los Angeles. And when I met up with Joe, I started out by asking him if he was nervous of taking on a film that was so rooted in American culture.
I think there's something to be said for an outsider's viewpoint. I always think of Bill Brandt, a German photographer who came and you know, in my book made the greatest photographs of the British experience in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And so I hope I was able to do to kind of give a slightly different perspective.
It's very interesting because recently we had in the director, so we had Kevin MacDonald, who'd gone to Washington to make State of Play, which was a film also it was about the last days of journalism well, the sort of dying art of newspapers, which your film also touches on. I suddenly thought we got these two quite young British directors making films that are very, you know, very kind of in love with the old journalism, with the production of newspapers.
I don't know if I'm in love with them.
Well, your film, there's some beautiful shots of newspapers being made.
I think the process. Yeah, I much prefer newsprint to online news and TV news. I think that there is an element of kind of, you know, when the guys kind of uncovered Watergate. They were on a payroll and their jobs were to go and investigate. Yeah. And if they didn't come up with anything, But they were investigative journalists, you know, and that's all they did. And that is dying out. People aren't paid, you know, people are expected to reporters are expected, as you know, to come up with kind of the goods. And the goods are usually, you know, a Lindsay Lohan crotch shot as opposed to exposing governments.
There weren't enough of those in your film, I have to say.
I tried to put some more in.
The Steve Lopez, who's your main character, the Robert Downey Jr. character, sort of happen across this great story. I mean, you do have a sort of real-life template with which to play from the soloist. How I haven't read his books and just seen some of his reports, which turn up in your film. Mm. How important was it for you to keep that mechanism of the story going, the fact that this was an investigation?
I think it's what drives especially the first half of the film. And there's a kind of tipping point. In a way, the film, you know, Steve for me is as much of the soloist as Nathaniel. And Steve is someone who, in a kind of typically 21st century way, objectifies the world rather than engaging with it. And he uses his job as a journalist to kind of objectify the world. He kind of likes to think he's engaging, but actually he's just sat on top of his hill.
There's all grist to his column, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, and he uses stuff and then spits it out. And the story for him is about the tipping point where he stops kind of keeping everything at an arm's distance and actually becomes involved emotionally with his subject, and the subject stops being an object, I suppose.
One could say that about filmmaking, about directors, that they can sort of turn up, especially sort of Hollywood, they had their reputation for sort of turning up, dumping the crew there, filming, then going again. Yeah. What I like about The Soloist is that it isn't one of those films. I mean, every sort of area of it, from the newspapers to the hospitals to the homeless, just gets a real empathetic feeling from you as a piece of work. Did you spend a lot of time?
I spent a lot of time there, and especially with the Skid Row community. When I first went over to LA, when I was thinking about taking the job, I was really, as I said, unsure that I could kind of had the authority to bring or to speak about an intrinsically American story, an experience. And I went down onto Skid Row. Steve Lopez took me down there, and I'm kind of quite scary at first. Lots of preconceptions, you know, crackheads all want to kill you. That's bullshit, by the way. And then he took me to LAMP, which is a shelter for people who have been diagnosed with a mental illness. And I met some really wonderful people there and really fell in love with them all, and was kind of fascinated by them. And it occurred to me that I might not have the authority to make a film about their lives, but they did, and I could employ them as actors.
Yeah. And I mean, they populate your film. Yeah. These extraordinary people.
And they also were, you know, part of the script development process. They were written into the film, and they acted in it. They were extras, and they were also consultants. And so they taught me how to
wonderful
make a
moment
film.
Where Robert Downey Jr. is listening to one of their stories, sort of playing the Steve Lopez part, and genuinely has hysterics at one of the ladies' clips. I mean, she's clearly mad, but you couldn't make an up story that she's on
this
kind of
eternal. And in a way, I kind of, that was a character. I mean, she was a character in the script that, I met a lot of actresses to play her, and they all were reading basically dialogue that was her verbatim, And none of them, you know, they were all acting and they were all putting on these kind of crazy performances. And it was just rubbish. And so in the end, I thought, okay, just have her do it. And that was the start of what became the most important part of the journey for me.
For you,
when I went to the studio and I said, "All right, I'll make the film on the condition that you allow me to employ 500 members of the Skid Row community," fully expecting them to say that they wouldn't be able to because of accountants and lawyers and tax systems and insurance and all that shit, you know, because Hollywood does live in a culture of fear of lawyers and litigation and pessimism, expecting the worst of people. But amazingly, they said yes. I think they thought I might change my mind or, you know, come to my senses. Yeah. But they said yes, and that was what we did, and that was the kind of the point of making the film.
Yeah. Joe Wright there, and The Soloist is on general release from this Friday, the 25th of September. And that brings to an end all we have for you on Film Weekly this week. Thanks again to Spike Lee, and if you've never seen Do the Right Thing, make it your business to do so. It is a modern classic, maybe up there with The Godfather. Speaking of must-dos, last week many of you entered our competition to win that soundtrack to Nick Love's film, The Firm. We had three to give away, and the winners are James Grant, Sandra Volcere, and Daniel Mutu. You knew that it was Gary Oldman who played the original Bex in Alan Clark's version of The Firm in 1989. Your CDs are on their way in all their Cool and the Gang, Oops Upside Your Head, Gap Band glory. Thanks to all who entered the competition. The music you've been hearing this week, apart from Fight the Power by Public Enemy, is of course the Cinematic Orchestra and their music for the Disney film The Crimson Wing. Beautiful, isn't it? All that's left for me to say is do pick up The Observer on Sunday for my trailer trash column as ever, and why not sign up to our Twitter feed? Film Weekly, that's us. Obvious, really. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my Film Weekly producer, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.